This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Syrian media says the country's air defenses have repelled an Israeli attack in the southwestern province of Kenyatta. The U.S. says it's disappointed by the U.N.'s top court ruling that it can hear Iran's bid to overturn Washington sanctions. And nearly a dozen Malian soldiers are killed in a militant attack on their camp in the country's troubled central region. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, Syrian air defenses have thwarted a fresh act of Israeli aggression in the southwest of the country. Syrian TV aired footage showing air defenses responding to the attack. Media said the Israeli attack targeted the Kenitra countryside, causing material damage only. Israel frequently conducts raids against positions inside war-torn Syria. The Syrian government says the Israeli regime, along with its Western and regional allies, are aiding terrorist groups wreaking havoc in the country since 2011. Earlier, we're joined by our Damascus correspondent, Muhammad Ali, for more details on the attack.
An official Syrian military source confirmed that there was an Israeli attack on Syria, saying that there is a new Israeli aggression carried out by the Israeli enemy on southern Syria. The details that were given were actually that the Israeli attack was carried out by both Israeli fighter jets from the direction, of course, of the occupied Syrian Golan, as well as Israeli missiles, surface-to-surface missiles that also targeted southern Syria. Now, the Syrian military source did not specify where exactly those Israeli missiles were aiming, only noting that the attacks were aiming at several targets in southern Syria. Reports say and indicate that Israel was attacking parts of Al-Quneitra and its countryside, while there was the air defenses were also seen in Damascus by the residents of Damascus. So there could be multiple, actually, targets that Israel was aiming to attack. The Syrian military source concluded by saying that the Syrian air defenses were able to intercept most of the Israeli missiles.
An Israeli drone has reportedly been shot down over an area in southern Lebanon. Local Lebanese broadcasters reported the incident, but an unnamed security source says the unmanned aircraft was in fact shot down. Israeli military claims missiles were fired at the drone but didn't hit it. Earlier this week, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah said that it downed an Israeli drone after it violated the country's airspace. The Israeli military has recently intensified violations of Lebanese airspace as part of spy operations against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over Lebanese airspace. Earlier, our Beirut correspondent, Matty Amsaleh, joined us with an update on the incident.
Well, what we have are from social media activists. Up until now, we do not have an official statement, neither from Hezbollah's resistance nor from the Lebanese army. Usually the Lebanese army, they might declare a statement saying what has happened if something related to Israeli aggressions. We have not had anything official yet. We do know from the Israeli army radio, that that Hezbollah did fire an anti-aircraft missile. They said that they have not recorded up until now that their drone went down or not, and we have images, of course, from social media showing an explosion in the skies over South Lebanon.
The International Organization for Migration says hundreds of Yemeni families have been displaced since the start of the year due to conflicts in several governorates of the country. Our correspondent in Sana'a has your details.
According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 600 families were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yemen in January due to the increasing confrontations in several governorates of the country.
The areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition suffer from instability, insecurity, and the spread of armed groups. Therefore, the residents of these areas are leaving to save their lives from missiles, projectiles, and armed confrontations. These have all been confirmed by the international organizations, including IOM.
The IOM says Al-Hudaydah, Al-Dala, and Taiz governorates have the highest number of displaced people. As the war continues in these areas, most displacements occurred during the last week of January, indicating that 2021 may witness more of this crisis.
The issue of displacement can only be solved by lifting the imposed siege. Those displaced greatly suffer from the absence of support from international organizations. These people must be among the priorities of the humanitarian operations. It is shameful to see an increase in the number of displaced people in 2021 due to the continuing armed conflicts.
Millions of families had to leave their homes for survival since the beginning of the war in Yemen in 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on the Arab country, killing thousands of civilians, including women and the children. 2021 doesn't seem to be better than the previous years for Yemenis, as the war continues to create new difficulties for thousands of people who had to migrate for their lives. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The International Court of Justice has ruled to take on Iran's bid to overturn U.S. sanctions, rejecting Washington's push to quash the case.
By 15 votes to 1, finds consequently that it has jurisdiction on the basis of Article 21, Paragraph 2 of the Treaty of Amity, Economic Relations and Consular Rights of 1955, to entertain the application filed by the Islamic Republic of Iran on 16 July 2018, and that the said application is admissible.
President of the ICJ added that court unanimously rejected all preliminary objections to its jurisdiction raised by the U.S. In a tweet, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif hailed the decision as another legal victory for the country. Conversely, U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said that Washington is disappointed that the U.S. top court did not accept what he called well-founded legal arguments. Tehran filed a lawsuit in mid-2018 after the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran accused Washington of breaching the 1955 bilateral treaty of amity and the ruining of millions of lives. In its previous ruling, the ICJ called on the U.S. to lift anti-Iran sanctions. Political commentator David Yagubian says that the U.S. will probably pull out of the International Court of Justice if the World Court condemns the country.
Even if the United States, due to this ruling, finally just pulls out completely from its commitments to international law or to, relative to the jurisdiction of the ICJ, it's nevertheless critically important for the world community that the continued rogue behavior and scofflaw behavior of the United States is recognized. And these are the proper channels through which to recognize it. So Interpol, maybe not the most direct and appropriate method within international law to address U.S. scofflaw behavior, especially in the context of its treaty obligations, which even after the 1986 reduction of ICJ jurisdiction unilaterally by the United States, it still claimed that its treaty obligations were still under that jurisdiction. But I do expect that the U.S. will just simply pull out completely from any jurisdiction or commitments or responsibilities to the ICJ, as well as to the ICC, which is pursuing Israeli war crimes in Palestine, as well as American war crimes in Afghanistan, some of those war crimes directly implicating Mike Pompeo.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has ruled out any changes or addition of new members to the 2050 nuclear deal. He made the remarks as the U.S. seeks to expand the agreement beyond Iran's nuclear issue. Here's more.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled that it is willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal from which former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally exited in 2018 and reimposed anti-Tehran sanctions. But 2 weeks after taking the helm at the White House, Washington's return to the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, still hangs in the balance. The U.S. says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord, but Tehran says it was Washington that walked away and hence it should fulfill all its obligations, which include the lifting of all sanctions. Amid the standoff, Iran's foreign minister warned that the Biden administration has a limited window of opportunity to re-enter the agreement. He, meanwhile, suggested the question over who must take the first step in returning to the JCPOA could be resolved by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
In reaction, the European Union said it is working extremely hard to salvage the deal and is in talks with the U.S. administration to see if sanctions could be lifted. And this is how the U.S. reacted to Zarif's suggestion.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same. And then we would then use that as a platform to build a longer and a stronger agreement that also addresses other areas of concern.
Such a stance was earlier echoed by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is in line with Washington's policy to expand the JCPOA beyond Iran's nuclear issue. French President Emmanuel Macron has also said Saudi Arabia should be involved in any new negotiations with Iran about the deal. But Iran's president has reiterated that the JCPOA remains unchanged.
I clearly tell the global community, and especially the countries in the JCPOA, whether it's 4 plus 1 or maybe 5 plus 1 in the future, that no clause of the JCPOA will change. Know this, and no one will be added to it.
After the U.S. pullout of the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, the EU, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Iran says its measures are fully reversible upon the full compliance by the remaining signatories. Presently, questions arise as whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or will try to rectify the Trump-era policy, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's close allies.
10 Malian troops have been killed in a militant attack on their camp in the central region of the country. Several soldiers were also injured in the raid. The troops' positions in the Mufti area was attacked by heavily armed individuals and armored vehicles. Camp was seriously damaged and assailants made off with lots of hardware. Militants close to the Al-Qaeda terrorist group have claimed responsibility for the attack. Raid is the latest in a series of brutal incidents which have been raging in the country since 2012. UN had also expressed concern regarding the situation in Mali, stating more than 2 million people in the wider Sahel region fled their homes due to violence. Germany has warned Russia with further sanctions over a court verdict against opposition figure Alexei Navalny and the use of police force against his supporters. A German government spokesman called Navalny's sentencing to 3.5 years in prison lawless. Other Western governments and rights groups have also slammed the verdict against Navalny and the arrest of protesters. This is while the Kremlin said that it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic matters. It also backed police actions against what it called unauthorized protests. Now, Germany, the UK, and the US have been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over the Navalny case, including his alleged poisoning. And earlier this month, Navalny was detained upon arrival from Germany for violating terms of his suspended prison sentence from 2014. Moscow has already warned the EU against linking bilateral ties to Navalny's case. The U.S. has extended the new strategic arms reduction treaty with Russia by 5 years. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made the announcement a day before the new START was set to expire. He expressed hope that it will prevent an arms race between the two nuclear rivals. This comes after Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a legislation which extends the accord. The new START is the last remaining arms reduction pact between Moscow and Washington, and it caps a number of nuclear warheads that the two sides can deploy to 1,550. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from other deals with Russia, including the 1987 INF Treaty. Former EU top-level technocrat Mario Draghi has been entrusted by the Italian President Sergio Mattarella with the task of forming a government of national unity after a sinking of negotiations to patch up a coalition that had supported the outgoing Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Max Tibili reports from Rome.
Italy's President of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, gave Mario Draghi a mandate to attempt to form a new government after efforts to salvage the coalition supporting outgoing Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte had failed. Draghi, 73 years of age, had largely vanished from public view since his mandate as President of the European Central Bank ended after 8 years in 2019. His name emerged as a potential prime minister when the government crisis sparked in Italy in mid-January. The crisis had been triggered by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, whose unexpected decision to withdraw his small party's support to the previous executive had forced Conte to resign.
Con questa speranza,
I am confident that the unity and the capacity to give a responsible response will emerge from the discussion with the parties, with the groups in Parliament. The challenges are to defeat the pandemic, complete the vaccination campaign, offer responses to everyday problems, and relaunch the country using the extraordinary resources from the EU.
The country desperately needs to secure an immediate massive injection of liquidity into its staggering economy. Italy has reported its biggest contraction in GDP since the end of World War II, following the pandemic. The National Bureau of Statistics estimates the country's economy shrank by almost 9% last year.
What is there to understand is if the next government will be technical or political. This is for Prime Minister-designate Draghi to find out. Draghi unusually met with outgoing Prime Minister Conte after receiving the mandate to see if he can also count on his support.
It cannot be taken for granted that a Draghi executive would win substantial backing from parties across the political spectrum. Many five-star movement lawmakers have said they will not vote in favor of a technocrat government led by Draghi, arguing the only possible executive must be a political one.
Also, nationalist Brothers of Italy leader Giorgia Meloni warned her party would not support Draghi as prime minister, calling her lies. The anti-immigrant, anti-EU League party of Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi's centre-right Forza Italia party to abstain any vote for him. Max Civili, Rome.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is preparing to resume deportations of asylum seekers after a Trump-appointed Texas judge ruled against a 100-day suspension ordered by President Joe Biden. The ruling, in response to a challenge from a leading figure in the Republican effort to overturn the election result, marks the first shot in a legal rearguard action by Trump loyalists intended to stymie the Biden administration's agenda. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Julian Borger. The piece is titled, U.S. to Resume Deporting Asylum Seekers After Judge Rejects Biden Order. Stay with us for more of Julian Borger's article. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is preparing to resume deportations of asylum seekers after a Trump-appointed Texas judge ruled against a 100-day suspension ordered by President Joe Biden. The ruling, in response to a challenge from a leading figure in the Republican effort to overturn the election result, marks the first shot in a legal rearguard action by Trump loyalists intended to stymie the Biden administration's agenda. Human rights activists said the resumption of flights also raised the question of whether Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, who have been accused of systematic abuse of migrants and detainees, might seek to resist the new administration's efforts to reform the agency. An Immigration and Customs Enforcement plane left San Antonio, Texas for Port-au-Prince in Haiti on Monday morning, carrying Haitians detained on the U.S.-Mexican border and expelled under a highly controversial ICE interpretation of public health laws. Deportation flight to Haiti on the first day of the Black History Month, Guerline Joseph, co-founder of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, wrote in a text to The Guardian, "What a slap in the face of the Haitian people." According to activists, there are also 23 Africans facing deportation from an Immigration and Customs Enforcement holding facility in Alexandria, Louisiana, as early as Tuesday, including 11 Angolans, 7 Cameroonians, 2 Congolese, and 3 others of unknown nationalities. Although the Haitian flight would probably have gone ahead even under the Biden moratorium, the expected African flight defies that order, as well as guidelines laid down by the acting Homeland Security Secretary, David Pekuska that came into effect on Monday, 1st of February. Pekuska called the deportations to be limited to suspected terrorists, convicted felons deemed a threat to public security, and undocumented people caught on the border after 1st of November. At least some of the potential deportees have legal cases pending, and one of them was granted an emergency stay by an appeals court judge on Sunday evening. Others expected to be deported on Tuesday or Wednesday. Immigration and Customs Enforcement appears to be pushing ahead with the deportation flight, despite reports that Cameroonians deported to their home country last October and November in the midst of a bloody civil conflict there had been imprisoned, beaten, gone into hiding, or in some cases simply disappeared. A lot of them were locked up in military prisons, which is where they took a whole bunch of people that are arrested by the army, said Mambo Tser, a Cameroonian community activist in the United States. Mambo Tser added, "It's not safe." Lauren Siebert, a Human Rights Watch researcher and advocate, said, "After scores of Cameroonians were denied asylum in the United States and deported in recent months, Human Rights Watch has documented multiple cases of deportees facing imprisonment, facing abuse, criminal prosecution, and threats by the Cameroonian authorities after their return. Some of their families have also been threatened and harassed." On taking office on 20th of January, the Biden administration ordered a 100-day halt to deportation flights, with certain limited exceptions, whilst Immigration and Customs Enforcement procedures were reviewed to enable focusing the department's resources where they are most needed. However, a federal judge in Texas, Drew Tipton, appointed by former President Donald Trump last June, ordered a stay, blocking the suspension, but not the new guidelines. Drew Tipton's nomination was opposed by Democrats over concerns over his lack of judicial experience and his support for the reinstatement of a Texas social worker fired for using a racial slur against a black colleague. He argued, "It certainly does not evidence a pattern of hostility against anyone or any people who are of a particular race." The case against the moratorium was brought by the Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, who played the leading role in the effort to overturn the November 2020 election result. Ken Paxton addressed Donald Trump's supporters in Washington on 6th of January, shortly before the storming of the Capitol building. "We will not quit fighting. We're Texans, we're Americans, and the fight will go on," he told the crowd, according to the Houston Chronicle. Ken Paxton has been indicted for securities fraud allegedly committed before he took office. He has also been accused of abuse of office by 7 whistleblowers and is being sued for retaliation after having the whistleblowers fired. He is reported to be under FBI investigation for the abuse of office allegations. Ken Paxton's lawyer, Philip Hilder, declined to comment on reports of an FBI investigation of Ken Paxton. After Judge Drew Tipton ruling on deportations, Paxton declared victory on his official Twitter account. "Texas is the first state in the nation to bring a lawsuit against the Biden administration," he wrote, "and we won." Echoing the language widely used to denounce the ransacking of the Capitol, Ken Paxton described the 100-day deportations moratorium as a seditious left-wing insurrection, which he had stopped. In a statement to The Guardian on Monday, an Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokesperson said the agency is in compliance with the temporary restraining order issued by the Texas court. Justice Department lawyers argued against the stay in Tipton's court. The Southern District of Texas but it was unclear when or whether they would appeal against the court ruling. A department spokesperson declined to comment. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, is seeking to challenge the Texan ruling on behalf of immigrant rights groups. There's a legal aspect to it, and there's a practical aspect, Cody Whoopsie, an American Civil Liberties Union attorney, said. Our individual Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers who may disagree with the new policies of the new administration going to carry out those policies, or are they going to attempt to carry out a more unforgiving immigration policy that they might prefer?
فارس و هرمز شانه به شانت سلسله کوه البرز وسعت نام تو وسعت نام خورشید جلوه خاک تو قرمز و سبز و سپید نمانم من نمان منم من ذره خاک وطنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ایران خاک دلیران ایران کنام شیران
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Talk about the laws of copyright according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939
When he began his Hausa studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about copyright-related laws, according to Ayatollah Khamenei,
yes.
Is it permissible for any intellectual, such as authors, translators, or even artists, to be remunerated or paid for the time, money, effort, and energy they put into such works and performances?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, the writers, authors, they have every right to ask the publishing or mm-hmm. institution or the publisher to demand actually whatever they like, okay, to demand, let's say, for compensation. Because an author spends, let's say, 1 year or 2 years to author a book, and it is such a time-consuming project. Sometimes you see,
yes,
and he hands it over to a publishing institute, and of course he may receive his wages for the first time, but for the second or third time, it depends on the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Grand Ayatollah Khamenei does not
specify.
Yeah, does not specify. He says he has the right to demand from the publisher whatever they or he likes for when he delivers his work to the publisher, and of course it can be he has the right to take a portion of what the publisher or the publishing company receives from the sales proceeds.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So imagine that the writer, translator, or artist received a payment or a fee for the first edition,
yes,
of any piece of work that they've been, in fact, cooperating or,
yes,
contributing to. And at the same time made a provision that they are to be given a share in the proceeds from the selling the subsequent edition.
Yes.
Are they justified, I mean, such payments, justified in demanding, or they as the writers?
Yes.
Justified in demanding a share of the proceeds of subsequent sales? If I'm not mistaken, we call them royalties, especially in terms of books, like the kind of copyright share or a percentage of this share that has to be given, in fact, to the writer, the original writer.
Yes.
And the company who works along with it, or the publisher, for example, has to pay that percentage to the original contributor.
Mm.
All right?
Yes.
So if it is a book, for example, they call it royalty. So
right.
How should such proceeds or the money, the shares, be treated?
Well, there we have to understand that there could be a law, in place, law in place requiring the publisher to remunerate for the book, or for the first or the second or the third, or let's say the 50th edition of a book.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two, let's say there are two suppositions. One supposition is that there is a law in place. That law is effective. It is applicable to the writer and to the publisher. So that law has to be abided mm-hmm. by both the writer and the publisher. If there is no law in place, then of course the Sharia comes forth. The Sharia has to decide whether the publisher, the original writer, has any right or not. Of course, again, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that, of course, it depends on the mutual agreement. Okay, if the two sides, if the two parties reach an agreement, whether he has to be paid for the second edition or the third edition or the fourth edition, as I said it,
yes.
Then that provision or that agreement has to be upheld. It has to be honored by the publisher and, of course, the writer, especially if he has given an original copy of his writing or his book to the publisher. Then he has to be paid and, of course, compensated for the second and third and fourth edition, let alone the first edition. La ilaha illallah,
Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Sheikh Shabit, sometimes we don't have such stipulations in the contract.
Yes.
All right? So suppose the author did not specify anything regarding the subsequent editions. Is it permissible for the publisher to reprint the material without the permission of the original author? And what if they don't pay the author?
I think there must be a kind of contract when, for the first time, the author is going to hand over his book or his work to the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
That contract could be verbal, it could be in written form.
Mm-hmm.
So that contract has to be, will specify whether the writer has to be paid or not. In either case, if the contract says that, okay, for the second or the third or fourth edition, the writer, the original writer, will not have to be paid, so they will go ahead according to the contract. And if the contract or the agreement stipulates that the original writer will have the right to be repaid and compensated, then of course the two sides will have to comply with that agreement, and the publisher especially cannot violate or cannot break or breach the contract, and cannot contravene, let's say, go or against the agreement made or reached between the two parties.
So what if they have forgotten, in fact, to include or incorporate such notes or such provisions in the contract?
If there is a case of, let's say, forgetfulness,
yes,
and they forget, I think Ayatollah Khamenei, as I said, exercises precaution. He mm-hmm. says it is a caution to preserve his right and ask his permission for the subsequent, let's say, editions. Okay?
Yes.
The subsequent editions has to be published after obtaining the writer's permission and consent.
Should they, in fact, refer to the law of that specific country then?
If there is a law in place,
yes,
and that law is actually...
like a third party, for example, to contract, or, for example, like an arbitrator, like a judge, an external judge who can observe and supervise, for example, such contract and pass judgment over this.
If there's an Islamic country, of course, they can reach out. They can contact the Muslim judge,
yes,
to pass to make a decision or mm-hmm. to pass a judgment,
yes,
between the two sides to settle the dispute and come to a solution. Okay.
If it is not a Muslim country,
if that is not, of course, there usually there is a law. The law is not in favor of either the publisher or the writer.
Yes.
The law could be based on some just principles.
Yes.
Okay. And if they accept the law, then these two people can turn to the law and of course decide and follow the law of the country of which they are a national. Okay. Mm-hmm. When it comes to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion, of course, Ayatollah Khamenei exercises precaution. He says it is a caution to preserve the right, okay? If the book is published for a second time or for a third time. Now, this caution is not a fatwa. I think I have been telling it many times,
mm-hmm.
and I have been told it several times that whenever a mujtahid exercises precaution, or in Arabic terminology, ihtiyat, then the duty bound, the mukallaf, has the right to choose to either stay to follow mm-hmm. the according
yes.
to act according to the precaution, or he can choose to follow the next mujtahid. Mm-hmm. The next mujtahid may have a fatwa or may not have a fatwa. If he has a fatwa, he can follow him. Otherwise, he cannot.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim, Mannan Kareem, Salam.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Irrespective of whether or not they keep the word, the UN and the West, if they are really sincere in their lip service for the world's most persecuted people, should seriously engage the military rulers to redress the plight of the Rohingya, instead of shedding tears for Aung San Suu Kyi and her so-called civilian colleagues, who had rigged the recent elections to secure 322 seats required to form the government. Dear listeners, these words were part of an article written by the staff of Kehan International. This article is published under the heading, "Would the cruel woman's ouster end cruelties for Rohingya Muslims?" Please stay tuned for the details of this article. Monday, February 1st, military coup in Myanmar, following widespread reports of fraud in the recently held parliamentary elections, has effectively ended the dubious power of the so-called democratic regime, which was anything but the people's true representative. Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, who seized power after a series of warnings by the military to the supposedly elected cabinet, has thrown into prison President Yu Win Myint and State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi, the woman who exercised the real power, including the intensification of the genocide of the Rohingya Muslims. The question that arises is, does the ouster of that cruel woman, to quote the apt description of Aung, ends the cruelties for the Rohingya Muslims? The answer seems in the negative. Given the cruel nature of General Min, who has overseen campaigns against several of the country's ethnic minority groups, including the Rohingya, the Shan, and the Kogong. In other words, the coup is not expected to improve the situation of the world's most persecuted people, as the UN has described the Rohingya Muslims. Presently, 1,300,000 Rohingya refugees live in squalid camps in Bangladesh, mostly in the Cox Bazar area. Following the mass exodus of the years 2017 to 2018, when Aung San Suu Kyi intensified the genocide in Rakhine State a year after her coming to power as an elected civilian ruler. A woman with a tarnished reputation because of her cooperation with the military and her vociferous defense of the deadly campaign against the Rohingya, during her trial in 2019 in the International Court of Justice, she tried to justify the ethnic cleansing of Muslims. It should be noted that UN officials and Human Rights Watch have described Myanmar's persecution of Rohingya Muslims as ethnic cleansing. The UN Human Rights Envoy to Myanmar has reported the long history of discrimination and persecution against the Rohingya community could amount to crimes against humanity. Probes by the UN have found evidence of increasing incitement of hatred and religious intolerance by ultra-nationalist Buddhists against Rohingya Muslims, while the Myanmar security forces have been conducting summary executions, enforced disappearances, arbitrary arrests and detentions, torture and ill treatment, and forced labor against the community. This means the coup that was announced on a military-owned Midawari TV would not bring any relief to the Rohingyas, unless the UN steps up efforts and pressures the new rulers to take back their refugees. The military rulers who cited the 2008 constitution, which allows the military to declare a national emergency, have declared a state of emergency and said they will remain in power for a year. Irrespective of whether or not they keep their word, the UN and the West, if they are really sincere in their lip service for the world's most persecuted people, should seriously engage the military rulers to redress the plight of the Rohingya, instead of shedding tears for Aung San Suu Kyi and her so-called civilian colleagues, who had rigged the recent elections to secure 322 seats required to form the government.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.